Welcome, everybody. What we're doing today is launching a special issue of the journal Conflict, Security and Development on identity politics and the political marketplace. My name is Mary Caldor, and I'm director of the Conflict Research Programme, which has produced this special issue. I'm going to chair and I'm going to say something, but before that, I'm going to introduce everybody else who's going to speak. We have Casper Hoffman, who is at the University of Copenhagen, and Casper will be talking about the Congo, about the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and in particular, the concept which we've developed, and I'll say something about, of identity capital. And then we have Zeynep Kaya. Zeynep has been part of our Iraq team, but she's now a lecturer at Bath and is about to be a lecturer at the University of Sheffield. And Zeynep has been incredibly important in our program because she's constantly reminded us that gender is constitutive of conflict. And she's going to be talking about the Yazidis in Iraq. And I should say that both Casper and Zeynep have done some really amazing field work in very difficult and traumatic situations. And then finally, we have Professor Shalini Randhira, who is director of the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, and also director of the Albert Hirschman Center for Democracy at the Graduate Institute of Geneva. And I'm really delighted to have Shalini because I was sitting in a meeting where Shalini said, the way to understand authoritarian populism is that it consists of three things: ethnic nationalism, crony capitalism, and toxic masculinity. And actually, this is the argument of our special issue. So that's why I was so keen to have her here. So I'm going, even though I'm the chair, I'm going to start by very briefly telling you about the main themes of our special issue. And then we can go on to Casper, Zeynep, and finally Shalini. So at the Conflict Research Programme, we explore something which my colleague Alex de Waal calls the political marketplace. So what the political marketplace is roughly the same actually as crony capitalism. It's a monetized form of transactional politics, or if you like it, you know, in most of the places we study, we've always had patronage and clientelism. But with the advent of globalization, this has really become about money. It's become monetized. So it's about the competition for power based on money. It's about access to government in order to get access to resources. And it's about gaining access to government through what Alex calls political budgets. It's, if you like, an extreme version of neoliberalism. It's systemic corruption. You know, even if you want to be a good politician and work for the provision of public services, for example, you can't in this system get into politics without a political budget, and you can't get a political budget without access to, I don't know, bribes from arms sales or creaming off aid. So that's what we mean by the political marketplace. And what is very striking in all our sites is that the political marketplace is associated with exclusivist identity politics. What do we mean by that? Well, we mean identity politics, which is singular. That's the term Amartya Sen uses to explain when one specific identity is more important than anything else. And he sees that as linked to violence. It's also binary, or if you like, exclusivist. It always tends to be directed against another. Shia versus Sunni, Hindi versus Muslim, Dinka versus Nuer in our South Sudan case. And it's also always somehow an effort to fit, to be fixed, to stay permanent, to be considered essentialist. So that's, and what is so interesting is that these two things happen to go alongside each other, whether it's because patronage networks are based on identity, whether it's because it's difficult to mobilize some other narrative, whether it's because the argument that I'm accessing resources on behalf of the an identity-based community works, whatever the reasons, we see them going hand in hand. So that's the first argument. The second argument is that identity politics is constructed. For anybody who works in academia on these issues, it seems somehow obvious. But the idea that identity politics is essentialist or primordialist, that it's ancient rivalries that have always been there, is what we call a zombie concept, using Ulrich Beck. It's a concept that is constantly killed off and yet somehow emerges again. And it is weird the way donors, politicians, journalists consistently insist that these conflicts are based on ancient rivalries. So, and what we find is, and this is what we show, is that these identity, this exclusivist form of identity politics is particularly constructed in violence. And there are two articles in our special issue which focus on that. There's one by Alex DeWall about Somalia, which shows how the sort of the clan system, which of course existed before but became fixed and polarized during the war in Somalia in the early 90s. Similarly, there's an article by Sami Hadaya about Syria, showing how the Sunni sectarian division, which didn't really exist, although in Syria before the war began, was constructed both by the government, which deliberately targeted Sunni areas and used a Shia, well, a narrative, and also by the opposition, who increasingly were funded by private Sunni Islamist donors in the Gulf. And I think linked to this is this Bourdieusian notion, which Casper will explain, of ethnic capital. Those of you who are familiar with the work of Pierre Bourdieu know he talked about social and cultural capital. And what he was referring to was hierarchies and orders based on who you know, networks of people that you knew in the case of social capital, or based on education, taste, culture in the case of cultural capital. In the conflicts we study, this kind of social and cultural capital is deliberately targeted. We see intellectuals being killed, we see the destruction of cultural heritage, and in its place is a kind of ethnic capital based on ethnic identity. You know, there's, I found actually thinking about what happened during the Brexit very helpful in thinking about this. There was a huge resentment against the educated classes, and somehow expertise was said it doesn't matter. And instead, what mattered was to be British, to have the privileged status of being British, particularly white. And that's what we mean. So I think this process of transformation of capital is really crucial to understand what happens in the conflicts we study. Finally, I should say, linked to all that, that both identity politics and the political marketplace are deeply gendered. And they do construct extremist patriarchal hierarchy, which Zainab will talk about some more. Now, the other thing that I wanted to say was that if you look at the role of outside powers, there is a tendency through top-down peace agreements to, if you like, freeze this combination of the political marketplace and identity politics. What we witness in all our conflicts is what Saskia Sassen calls the disassembly of the state, increasing fragmentation, increasingly new political entities that are often identity-based. And in very often, the outcome of peace agreements is to make this permanent, to entrench the position of these, if you like, ethnic crony capitalists, something we saw, for instance, in Bosnia or in Lebanon. And then the final point I want to make that comes out of all our studies is that the relationship between identity politics and the political marketplace is by no means harmonious. They actually give rise to all sorts of turbulence. And the reason being that the logic of identity politics very much has to do with passion and hatred, whereas the logic of the political marketplace has to do with individual, rational, amoral calculation. And so this is not a simple correlation. It's one that gives rise to contradictions and openings that could easily be exploited for other purposes. One of the articles that we include in this special issue by Naomi Pendle is called The Dinka of Nur We. And it's Nur We means Nur money. And it's about a politician, a Dinka politician who decides to ally with Nur politicians for transactional reasons. And the international community is absolutely delighted because it looks like a kind of solution to the problems of South Sudan. But he could not carry his supporters with him. And that is a very good example of this kind of contradiction. In fact, I mean, there's an added complication here, which is for the Dinka, cattle is probably more important than money. But anyway, you should read the article to have the story. So I think those are the sort of key, I hope I've tried to present the key arguments in this book. I realize I've left out also that one other point, which is, as well as being gendered, both the political marketplace and identity politics are transnational. The political marketplace is very much a consequence of the globalization of finance. And identity politics is linked into transnational identity-based networks. And we do have one article about the Middle East and about, if you like, geosectarianism across the Middle East. So with that sort of basic introduction, I will turn to Casper.
Right. Thank you, Mary. I hope you can all hear me. And thanks for showing up and listening to our talk. I should start saying that, you know, the article that this small talk is based on, I wrote together with Kun Flasenroth, Tatjana Karayannis, and Godefroy Mousalia, who's a professor at the Institut Supérieur Pédagogique in Bukavu in Eastern Congo. So it's by no means my contribution and thoughts that I present here. So I just wanted to make sure that everybody knew that. I'd like to say that the point of departure of our article is that we'd like to try to understand the relationship between ethnicity and conflict in DRC. Now, this is, of course, a very tall order, but we try to do it in a sort of broad perspective, presenting various examples, small case studies rather than one long single case study, which we've tried to do elsewhere, some of us. And we found when trying to understand the function or the role of ethnicity in the Congolese context of, you know, both politics and conflict and eventually also violent conflict, neither of the so-called classical perspectives, so which, you know, somewhat simplified, you can call materialism, bar instrumentalism, constructivism, and primordialism, really was able to capture what was going on, or how ethnicity and conflict and politics sort of interact. We started thinking about it in a sort of, let's call it a more holistic perspective, and using ideas of, you know, a social field developed by Pierre Bourdieu, notably, as Mary mentioned, and also others, of course. And the idea here being that, you know, economic issues are also social, are also political, meaning that you cannot understand issues of identity apart from politics or economics. And having said that, we do acknowledge, as Mary also mentioned, that what we call today ethnicity, or, you know, race, if you like, are historically produced and dynamic and flexible, rather than static, bounded, and homogeneous. So we are not disputing that in any way or form. But it's very important not to stop the analysis there, which is, for instance, what has happened quite a lot in, for instance, the study of ethnicity in Africa, through what is called the invention of the ethnicity school of thought, where it's rightly pointed out that it's, shall we say, constructed and invented, but it fails to explain how it interacts with politics, how it interacts with violence, how it interacts with the economy. This is why a sort of holistic perspective is more valuable. So we think we can say, apart from the fact that they are, that ethnicity is constructed and historical and so on and so forth, this is perhaps the key point, it's a symbolic resource. It's a symbolic political resource, which we call ethnic capital, which can be deployed by certain actors, actually all actors, but they can only do so, I mean, they can do so more or less effectively. And apart from that, ethnic capital also, you know, is unequally distributed, just like all other forms of resources. And, you know, this is an insight that, you know, let's say scholars from the Black radical tradition could have told us a long time ago, if enough attention had been paid to what someone like Du Bois wrote. But, you know, it's this intersection between the economy, politics, exclusion, marginalization, and so on and so forth, whereby certain groups, are more richly endowed with what we call ethnic capital. So it's in this sense that ethnicity is sort of embedded in the structures of reward and discrimination of society. This also goes for the Congo, but it takes a particular form, we argue, which is not dissimilar to other colonial states, but of course it has its own unique historical trajectory. And this I will just briefly, or at least like to outline. I should say that it's not possible to conjure up ideas or, you know, ethnic identities out of the blue. This is another crucial point. You know, it has to somehow resonate with existing imaginaries of identities. And often so, it becomes, let's say, dominant imaginaries of who you are, who you belong to as a group. And to which people have emotional attachments and beliefs and about who they are or who they should become. And it's by evoking those, it's only by relating somehow to those that it can become an effective symbolic capital, if you like. So going back to the Congo, in order to understand the salience of ethnicity in Congo, one must perforce work historically. And we argue that the way in which ethnic identity politics shape the conflicts in the Congo owes a lot to colonial practices of power. It's undeniable, we think, because ethnicity was institutionalized basically through processes of categorization, bar identification, and territorialization. And this occurred mainly through what was called the creation of chieftaincies or chefferies in French, but also through other means or other techniques of government, if you like, if you allow me to paraphrase Foucault here, you know, identity cards or passports of traveling. You know, you could not travel to another chieftaincy or to a city without having a permit to do so because you were legally assigned to be in a certain chieftaincy. And as a member of a given tribe or ethnic group. You know, of course, it's going to be a bit, jumbly historically, but as it were, indigenous populations were assigned to live in tribal homelands and ruled by a single monarch-like chief. And this, again, was a construction. I mean, especially in a geopolitical artifact like the Congo, which was, you know, basically an agreement between the major powers that be at the time, the free trade zone. The diversity of culture and politics and you know what we call identities, you know, was immense. But the colonizers, thought they could make it manageable by creating so-called chieftaincies with a sort of authoritarian hierarchical structure around the chief and his counselors. And most of the time, these chiefs were not sort of chosen through, indigenous rites of initiation or anything like that. They were chosen because they accepted, the values of civilization, because they were willing to collaborate, and most of all, because they were able to provide the demands given to them by the state. And probably most of you know, the obscene level of bloodletting that went on in the Congo by the Congo Free State. Now things, of course, changed later on, and it became more, less disaster capitalism and pure savagery, but more sort of, the governance of ethnicity through their own norms. So kind of like what is also known as indirect rule. So anyway, all this whole territorialization of ethnicity, and I'll just briefly share a map. I hope I can still do this to give you an idea of how this looked like in the minds of the colonizers. I hope you're able to see this map that I put on. Can you see it?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so this is a map produced by a governor called Alfred Müller de Ladassus. He was famous for his, for his native policy, politique indigène, as it were, insofar as he put a lot of effort into, ethnographic surveys and data collection and so on and so forth. And so he prided himself of being someone who really sort of governed along the lines or according to the customs of Eastern Congo. However, he failed to mention how much he actually changed and transformed and violated existing, cultural heterogeneity. Because as you can very well see, I suppose, these areas, each of these names, labels are supposed to represent a mono-ethnic territory, whereas in reality, they had nothing to do with this kind of ethnic state-like, most of them anyway, state-like structure, which basically just was an emulation of European ideas about what it means to belong to a state, or a political community. And at the same time, it had the advantage of rendering them manageable in the minds of the colonizers. This, of course, did not turn out to be the case because there were lots of rebellions, resistance, and so on and so forth, and it produced all kinds of problems. But this was a sort of imagination, ethno-territorial imagination, that the colonizers brought with them. The point is not that this was, the point is also first that it was, of course, deeply violent, a deep, very deep symbolic form of violence, but it also created, an imaginary of what it means to be, a subject in the Congo or as a political subject in the Congo. And so far as people started, seeing themselves through these maps, and these maps became very political in as far as they were never sort of delegitimized after colonization. So that's, I mean, they were, the actual boundaries were, but the concept of an ethnic territory has never really been fundamentally challenged, only in this brief period under Mobutu, but that's too much detail to go into. I should say very briefly, or mention that the colonizers did not do this work by themselves, because there's been it would also be, you know, we need to recognize the agency of certain African elites or indigenous elites here, especially the royal elites with whom the colonizers were collaborating, because they were the ones that the colonizers sort of collaborated with, from whom they got the facts, so the ethnographic facts on the ground. Meaning that the creation of each and every one of these territories was basically a struggle for the definition of boundaries, in which also the indigenous elites were very active and had all kinds of interests, and some of them were not even the royal elites, but someone who claimed to be, and then had a strange ally, very powerful allies, and then they managed to sort of grab power and present reality in a certain way to the colonizers. So that it's important to mention. And furthermore, along those lines, the customs or the cultures that the colonizers sort of evoked and invented were based on existing values. I mean, otherwise it would never have worked. That's so it was not just invention from scratch. Right. So what is the connection for today, until today? Well, some armed political actors, So the basic structure of colonial rule remains in place, and access to resources, political representation, and even citizenship is linked to ethnic territories directly. Further, they have shaped people's ways of thinking about politics. The question of defining the social spatial boundaries of these ethnic territories are very important, as it directly impacts who can claim authority over resources and population. By the same token, the question of who's to be the customary chief, and of which we have a small case actually in the paper, and another paper with a very long case, but that's a different story, is often highly important, because the chief, with the kind of authority, almost its royal authority invested to him by the colonizers, gives him usually quite a lot of authority over local resources and people. And so they become very important intermediaries for other external actors, like external states or armies or the Congolese state. So like really a broker, although in some cases their power is also, dwindling, because they're losing land and so on. But okay, in very general terms. Now, some armed political actors routinely claim to protect such ethnic territories from encroaching foreigners. At the same time, others claim they have the right to one due to their status as indigenous populations. And, so there's a talk of war between who belongs where and who does not belong, and who is an encroaching foreigner. And this process is literally almost endless. The level of fragmentation, the potential of fragmentation, is almost endless. And why is this? It's because the maps are very generalizing, and in some areas there were not initially, before the colonizers came, this kind of geopolitical imaginary of ethnicity. But cultures and polities that were much more fluid, and identities that were much less fixed, and there are lots of potentially legitimate claims amongst different elites to create their own territories. And you see it very much, if as soon as someone perhaps gets something recognized in terms of an ethnic territory, there's a small group popping up and say, hey, look, we also have a claim to an ethnic territory, because my father, he migrated here in this and this and this age. And, so we want power over these resources as well. And these people, you cannot just come, you are a foreigner. And it goes down actually to the village level. It's incredibly fragmented and polarizing. All right, okay.
We'll come back to you, Asper. Okay. We'll come back to you. Don't worry. You can say more. But we're right. going a bit. We're all being a bit longer than we should have been.
Yeah, I apologize. But that's I was okay. almost at the end.
I think I was too. So Zeynab now, and you. Yeah, great.
Thank you, Mary. I will, considering the time, I think we are halfway into the session. I'll try to keep it as short.
One third into the session. So we've still got an hour.
Great. But I'll try to not to go into too much detail. I just want to make a couple of points in relation to the research I conducted about the Yazidis. So for those who don't know the case, I'm sure everybody here knows the case, but just for the sake of clarity. The ISIS, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, in the summer of 2014, executed thousands of Yazidis in the Sinjar area. And it seized very large numbers of women and children as hostages. And we are talking about 10,000 Yazidis who were killed or kidnapped. And this is a very small community in Iraq, less than a little bit around 500,000 in Iraq. Obviously, Yazidis are also dispersed across the world. Even before ISIS's attacks, there are Yazidis living in other parts of the world as well. Those that managed to escape the attacks were displaced, and the vast majority are still living in displacement camps because they can't go back to Sinjar, back to their homes. Just to mention that not all Yazidis are from Sinjar, so they are they live in different parts of the Nineveh Plains, Bashika, also the Kurdistan region, Iraqi Kurdistan. But those who had to run away from Sinjar have not been able to go back to their homes because they don't feel safe, their houses are destroyed, and so on and so forth. And a small number of them have moved to Western countries as refugees. And what's more, several thousand Yazidis remain, men and women and children, remain unaccounted for. And the task of identifying and documenting their bodies, including mass graves, still continue. So most Yazidis have no intention of returning to their home province, Sinjar, as I mentioned, given their traumatic experiences, also their lack of confidence, most importantly, in efforts to reconstruct and securitize the area, and also the lack of progress in bringing justice. And obviously those who know the Iraqi context, justice is an elusive concept that's mainly combined with retaliation or especially the way the Iraqi government has practiced the policy of justice after, for instance, the collapse of the Iraqi regime, the Ba'ath regime, and the establishment of the new regime. It mainly took the form of purges and excluding particular communities from power, from access to services. And it was very much based on particular identities. So it's like a reinstituting the privileges that were lost by a particular community and then depriving a particular community from certain rights. So that kind of justice has obviously, that understanding of justice has a long history, not in Iraq, in many countries. And in that context, Yazidis are not expecting, I guess, justice. And also as a minority group, they don't have much leverage in the political decision making at all. They are not also getting the explicit, forceful international support in terms of bringing justice to their issues. So right now, justice for Yazidis is mainly taking place in the courts of Iraq. ISIS members are being tried based on the terrorism law tried and punished in that sense, you know, mainly executed. But within these crimes, crimes in war, genocide, sexual violence don't come up. So they are not punished for those crimes. They are punished for carrying out terrorist acts, basically. So Yazidis are, and not only Yazidis, other communities, minority communities in Iraq that suffered violence of ISIS are also not receiving that kind of justice. So that's kind of the intro. What this paper, and this is not a, you know, extremely original point. What I try to do is to use the existing wisdom in the gender studies and feminist studies on the relationship between gender and violence and apply this to the case of Yazidis. And what I try to do is mainly two things analytically. One of them is to situate sexual violence within the continuum of violence, both historically, but also horizontally in the society at a point in time. So what I mean with this is that the conception of sexual violence here very much takes sexual violence as connected to other forms of gender-based violence. They are not different types of violence, they are interconnected, and there is a continuity between them. And secondly, past practices of violence, gender structures, gender norms, the way the states or communities have organized their gender relations, and how this was institutionalized within political, economic, social, legal structures historically has shaped what we see today, or what we have seen in the case of ISIS today. So these are not like, ISIS is not necessarily an anomaly or an entirely new form of violence. It has used a huge repertoire of violences that exists already in that context. So those are the two key points that I try to make. And then and the main argument is that gender is a central, not a tangential component of violence. And gender norms are an essential part of singular and exclusive identity formation, at least in the way it's been constructed in this particular context. In the case of ISIS and the Yazidis, what we have seen is that specific ethnic and religious constructions of identity intersected with gender, with patriarchal and hierarchical forms of gender relations, leading to a militarized masculine warrior mentality and targeting, and this being used to target a minority community. And in a way, ISIS used sexual violence in forming its own group identity against a subordinated group, outgroup, which is Yazidis and other Shia Turkmen, Christians, Christian women, and so on and so forth. So just to briefly say a couple of more words on the historical context. So what I mean with this is that ISIS, the wider inequalities, so we need to emphasize, I just want to emphasize the wider inequalities and structural context within which the violence took place. The historical and structural factors in social, political, economic relations has created a context for particular individuals or identity groups to be targeted over others. For instance, ISIS relied on what the Ba'ath regime did against its opponents or women, or how it managed gender relations, and the practices were very much used as a repertoire by the ISIS to create hierarchies and also patriarchal relations. ISIS relied on them. I think I'm going to, because I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip this part, but wanted to end with two points. Right now, I'm working on a project funded by GIZ. It's Peace and Women in Iraq. It's about peace and women in Iraq. And it tries to understand the conceptions of peace and the issues women have about the way peace is and peace and justice is being done in Iraq. So we look at, we have talked to 90 respondents working on peace from Kirkuk, Erbil, Nineveh, Baghdad, and Najaf. The point about I made about justice came up quite significantly, and the relationship between gender and violence, and the relationship between peace and gender, and peace and justice and gender. So two things that was really heavily discussed in relation to this issue were the camps that the so-called ISIS families are located right now, and their children. And there are some brutal examples and stories coming from those camps. They not only live in terrible circumstances, they are basically trapped in those camps. And there is no proper identification of who is actually ISIS member, who have been forced to be an ISIS member, and whether are we talking about some of the women might be entirely, you know, innocent, and they just happen to be in the wrong time, in the wrong place, but they are treated brutally, and their children don't have identification. So most of the Iraqis talked about the camps as like time bombs. And they also talked about the unfair treatment of these women without due process, without due judicial process, including raping women because simply they were a wife of an ISIS member, for instance, you know, and these types of sexual violence taking place, unfortunately, and this was mentioned by many, many people. So I don't have evidence, but it's quite disturbing to hear. And the Yazidi law is being now discussed in the parliament. It hasn't passed yet, but now it's being developed to be more comprehensive of other minority groups, not only Yazidis who have been affected by ISIS's violence. And there are debates about this as well. And I will end it there, I think. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Zeynep. And now I'll turn to Shalini, who is a commentator rather than having written something. Shalini, you have to unmute.
Unmute myself. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much for the invitation and for these really interesting papers. So let me make a set of three general comments and then come to the two specific papers. Mary, my first one goes to you, which is to say, I think I think crony capitalism is probably an easier way to describe political markets. Because I think the whole question of the market then needs to be unpacked, and what kinds of markets are these? But when you say you think it's an extreme version of neoliberalism, I'm not very sure if that's a good description, because I think that neoliberalism is very much about depoliticization. It's very much about the ideological argument is to take all kinds of political agencies, government, state, out of the realm of the market. So actually what political markets, if one takes just the coinage of the concept seriously, is doing is exactly mixing the two realms, which neoliberalism is trying to disentangle. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it follows a neoliberal logic. I think it muddies that neoliberal logic. Just as my argument on crony capitalism has always been that a lot of the critique of these regimes is that they are neoliberal, but I don't think they are neoliberal. I think a lot of the examples which we can go through, like Hungary, Turkey, India, these are crony capitalist regimes. These are not neoliberal ones, because actually what you are doing is using certain kinds of patronage and power of the state in order to ensure that money, resources, land, concessions go to certain people in your patronage network. networks, and they are usually not multinational companies in these cases. I mean, in the Hungarian case, yes, but the other two to certain capitalists in the country. So this is actually exactly the opposite to a neoliberal logic. So I think we need to think about where the political marketplace and neoliberalism, how they go together. My second point is a general point to all of you on the question of identities. I think what you are describing is something which the Indian political scientist Sudhito Kaviraj had a very, very good article on already, I think in the 90s, in which he was describing the transformation of what he called fuzzy identities into enumerated identities. Mm. And this is, it's based on also Bernard Cohen's old work in the 60s on the census and the why the census was such an important instrumentality of government. In colonial India. So the argument, I think, and that is something which one needs to think through with your material, is a very clear one in Sudipto Kaviraj's case. He's saying what you had were pre-modern identities, and they were multiple, they were fluid, but they were fuzzy. The boundaries of the community, which were the identity bearers, were fuzzy boundaries because you did not have a modern political logic which was based on the arithmetic of majorities and minorities. These were pre-modern societies in which numbers didn't matter. Nothing was predicated on whether there were more Dinka or more Hutti or more Tuts or not. This was a question of having identities which could go with, if you were a cattle-rearing community, you could be a member of community X. If you married into an agrarian community, you could become Y. It didn't matter because the numbers didn't matter. Once these fuzzy identities become enumerated identities through census taking and a lot of resource allocation, including political representation, begins to be predicated on the numbers, then enumerated identities have a very different salience. And they are not only important for donors, they become important mechanisms for even self-description and self-representation of people. So it's not that donors are chancing upon identities which actually are still very fluid, but these have already been stabilized through many, many centuries in the Indian case, which was his case, but also in other, in the African case, maybe of many decades of colonial rule. So I'm not very sure if the argument here is that violence or the current civil war conditions are creating these identities. If that is the case, then we have new emerging collective identities, which are different or are in some ways related to, but it's unclear to me how and why, to the earlier ones which the colonial governments created. So I think one needs to think a little bit more about those, because the old anthropological literature on Africa, and there's a lot of it on this whole topic, is saying one of the things which maintains the balance in these political systems is the cross-cutting nature of identities. The fact that they are not singular identities, but they are cross-cutting, and that maintains a certain kind of balance. So it is a huge anthropological literature already in the 50s and 60s and 70s on all of this. So I think one needs to think about that there. There, the role of the state becomes important, both the colonial and the post-colonial state. Then I come to your idea with Saskia Sassen's idea of the disassembling of the state. And I think we need to think about what kinds of states these are. So I was saying when I said at that meeting that I think what you are getting these days are so-called, in my view, soft authoritarian states, that they are mixing certain kinds of elements of democratic elections with authoritarian politics, plus violence, but that they're all characterized by crony capitalism, toxic masculinity, and ethno-nationalism, because they need this binary opposition of us versus them. And that is already a logic of minorities and majorities. But these are, in my view, these post-colonial states are all states of endemic expropriation. And I think one really needs to now look at the what kinds of resources are being expropriated and from whom, and how does ethnic politics play into the politics of dispossession and expropriation. Because I think one really now needs to, if we are thinking in terms of bringing the symbolic and the material domains together, I think that's one of the kinds of questions we need to ask. So I don't think there is a binary between identity politics and rational legal institutions. So the contradiction which you were pointing out to between, as you said, the logic of identity politics, which is a logic of passions, versus the logic of the political marketplace, which is rational, amoral, this may be an empirical contradiction in a particular case, but I don't think it's an analytical contradiction, because you can have, first of all, identity politics, if it coalesces around majorities in political systems, then it has a logic which is very rational. It's not just fashion-based. So I think we have to think what is the political logic of identity politics, and to see if that collides with the marketplace logic. And secondly, the two can align quite well together when you are building up your patronage networks in the political marketplace based on identity politics. So they don't have to be at cross purposes. In an empirical case, they may be, but I don't think there's an analytical contradiction. So those are sort of my general remarks. And now the two cases. On Kaya's case, I found this whole question of gendered violence and that being really something which is constitutive or co-constitutive of violence to be a very important one, and the idea that there is a sexual objectification here. Two questions to you on this. One, on the nature of, I think, toxic masculinity. You were very much focused on the gendered identities of women. I want to take you into the masculine identities, because the perpetrators are, in your case, mostly men, or probably almost all men. Of the violence against Yazidi women. So I think one needs to think about the masculine identities, which are also being built up as part of this process. And then I want to turn your attention not to the minorities, in the case of the Yazidi, definitely a minority community, but look at the gendered identities of the majority community. Because what we have seen in Hindu-Muslim riots, and really violent ones, in the Indian case, for example, Hindu women have been very much part of this configuration. So it's, yes, there is a certain masculinity construction, but there is also the construction of gendered identity on the side of the perpetrators. And that is also women's identity on the side of the perpetrators. So I think one needs to have a larger picture on this. And the second question I would have to you is on the question of justice. Where do Yazidi women go to when they, what are the kinds of fora that they can go to? So one of the things I was reading about a case was in a German court recently of one of these Iraqi men who was convicted. So I think we should start thinking about transnational legal fora in this case. And that comes back to my argument on looking at the state as well, because I was, you know, disassembled states are interesting in the way that they are partly privatized states and partly transnationalized states. And I think it may be interesting to take the state apart as an actor here and try and understand, in this fragmented state, what are the parts which are privatized, which are the parts which are transnationalized and aligned with which international organizations, and why, to understand the new assemblage or new configuration of the state, and to try and see if that can help further, and then to think about legal pluralism, to think about the plurality of fora in which justice can be sought from the local level to the transnational level, because I have seen a lot of very interesting work, which we may not like normatively, but empirically, the point is that a lot of the Afghan fighters, or even the ISIS, that they have justice fora of their own. And because the state is non-functional in many cases, groups of militarized men have set up fora both in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And there's interesting work on that, empirical work, which is very, very rich in showing what kinds of fora for justice, which is, of course, not the forum to which the Yazidi women can go to, but which doesn't mean there aren't other alternative justice foras, forums. Last set of questions for Casper. Casper, I was a bit unsure of this, what is really new about this argument, because for the region that you are making this argument, for example, Terence Turner's work, Young's work, David Newbery's work, even Mehmood Mamdani's work on Citizen and Subject, has been telling us many of the parts of the story that you are telling about the construction of identities, that it's not primordial. This is all of anthropology already in the 80s and 90s, which is taking exception to the primordialness of these identities, showing their instrumentalization, showing, however, that you can't cut a new constructed identity from the air. You have to have some kinds of pieces from which you're assembling it for it to have a resonance. So this is what we know. The theoretical part of it, we also know quite a bit from Andreas Wimmer's work, for example, on ethnic identities and nationalism. So I wasn't quite sure as to what exactly is a new argument that you are making here, particularly because I think maybe it's not available in English. So I don't know if you read any German, but maybe you need somebody to translate it for you. I think there's excellent work on exactly what you're doing by Georg Elvert, who used to teach at the Free University in Berlin. And he had a very interesting concept already published in 1998 in a paper on what he in German called Gewaltmärkte, markets of violence. And this is interesting, particularly for Mary and for Casper, because the argument which he's making on these markets of violence are in papers which he has written for the German Ministry of Development Cooperation and for German development aid agencies. So he's explicitly addressing them and saying, you're barking up the wrong tree completely because you are not recognizing what is really happening on the ground. And just let me give you 3 points, and I think those would be important for your argument. He is making the argument that these are markets because they go anywhere from robbing people of things with violent means to proper market exchange. So that's why he's bringing these two terms together. He said it's about tax collection at the point of the gun, it's about protection money, it's about extortion. But don't forget, all of these guys are ethnic entrepreneurs who are into violence also for profit. And war needs planning and it needs logistics and you need money and you need money. So there's an economy of war and you need the money to buy diesels, to buy weapons, to buy ammunition, to buy food. And the whole question of how they are getting to the economy, the resources to be able to do it for Afghanistan later, we have also good work on this. But so I think what he was trying to do was to show how there is an economy of war organized around violence for profit. And then he shows why there are routines in this area, but because they are areas in which no rules can be established, you do not have a monopoly of violence. You have warlords who are establishing routines, and then you have to make a distinction between routines and rules. And that's a very interesting distinction that he makes. And he says the violence follows an economic imperative. So they are making certain kinds of routines work for them, which are not legal. They are not legitimate, but they are the routines which everybody knows and adheres to in these areas. And then he makes a further point for the development agencies, and he's showing in many, many conflicts in DRC as well, but also in Liberia, etc. He's making a very large general argument for Africa. He was an Africanist. He said a lot of the food aid which humanitarian agencies and development organizations are sending well-meaningly into this area is being siphoned off, particularly in Liberia at that point of time when he wrote it, to feed the troops in the wars. So it's not as if your food aid is reaching the people you're wanting it to reach, but you are actually fueling the conflict by sending this kind of aid, which can then get cornered. And in fact, he shows in some of his writings that the refugee camps themselves become the places where the troops get sheltered, and the troops are then given all the aid which is being sent into the camps. And the last point he's making, I think it's also interesting because you had newer and Dinka examples, that he's saying in a lot of earlier traditional pre-modern African contexts, you had rituals of masculinity, which were about, in the Dinka case, about owning cattle. And he says the new rituals of masculinity are the rituals of masculinity in violence and war. So these boys are now growing up not owning cattle, but proving their mettle in these violent conflicts. So there is another angle to masculinity and the kinds of conflicts that we are witnessing at the moment. So I think it would be interesting to look at some of this very, very rich ethnographical literature to try and situate your own argument against what is already available on these questions. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Charlene. That was fantastic. I think what I'll do is I'm going to start by just answering a couple of your points or commenting on a couple of your points. Then I'm going to hand over, then we have one question that we were given by the audience beforehand, which I'm going to ask and ask Casper and Zainab to reply, and you if you like. And then we'll take more questions from the audience. So just on a couple of points, one about, is the word market really the wrong word? I'm not sure personally, but what I do find is that Alex and his team have been able to use the language of markets quite successfully as a way of describing different configurations of ethnic entrepreneurs. So, you know, there's Syria was a monopoly. Other places are oligopolies. So they've done this in rather interesting ways, which help us to understand the nature of the conflicts. Is it an extreme version of neoliberalism? I guess what I really meant was it's an extreme outcome of neoliberalism. And it's in two respects. One is, of course, extremes of inequality, which are consequent. And very often what you find is people, as a result of neoliberalism, being pushed off the land, men who can't afford to marry and who are recruited into the new militias. But on the other aspect of it is what you were calling privatization or the contracting out culture. And Alex and I have had a lot of discussions about, is it really the consequence of the contracting out culture or is it the consequence of rentierism? I don't know the answer to that, but that's an interesting question to pursue. So I think I should have said more correctly, it's an extreme outcome of neoliberalism. On identities, my argument would be that these identities have to be reproduced every generation. So in one generation, the fuzzy identities become fixed, and in another generation, they become fuzzy again. And in particular, in the post-colonial period, national identities very often overcame these more local, ethnic, and other identities. Certainly in the Syria case, it was hard to see a clear, actually, Alawi-Sunni divide. There was an Alawi minority in government, but nevertheless, you know, you talk to anybody in Syria and they say, we really don't understand how this has happened. And there was a deliberate policy of turning these out. Of course, they exist in the imaginaries, as Casper says, but turning them into fixed, singular and exclusive identities is what happens during violence. I think those were, and then of course, finally, of course, I agree with you, they're aligned. I only introduced the contradiction to show that it's actually not a simple, it isn't just the political marketplace and exclusive identity politics go together. To sustain that alignment, and that's maybe another way of putting it, involves constant turbulence, contradiction, and violence. None of these places, these are the forever wars, And the forever war is this social condition of the combination of the political marketplace and ethnic violence and an extreme unstable version of masculinity that can only be reproduced through gender violence. Mm-hmm. And so these contradictions are why it goes on forever and it's so difficult to reply to deal with. Now, that brings us to the question, which I'm going to ask everybody at while they respond to Shalini, which is what channels of influence and key stakeholders and or approaches to leverage the political marketplace have you identified to help reshape identity politics towards more inclusive and peaceful societal dynamics? I'm interested to better understand what actors matter, e.g. specific elites, private sector actors, civil society organization, regional actors, etc. Why and what channels approaches have proved more effective to leverage them? Well, I'm going to ask everybody to answer that question. Let me just say one thing. In our work, we actually identify a third logic, which we call the logic of civicness. And in some senses, all modern states are based on a theoretically civic template, namely that there's a parliament, a justice system, elections. And of course, historically, those civic templates were very exclusive. They were privileged by class, by race. The empire was left out. We have Mamdani's subject and citizen. But with post-colonialism, all of the states we study, in theory, had this civic template, but actually it's a civic template that is constantly subverted by the political marketplace and by identity politics. But what we observe in all our sites is either municipalities that actually do operate on a civic logic, using their revenues to provide public services, for example, trying to maintain local peace. We find individuals, whether in government or in society, doctors, teachers who refuse sectarianism, or judges who are actually honest. And then we also find, so we find people, and everywhere, something that very much comes out of the Congo studies, there is a sort of sense of something called citizenship, which actually doesn't exist, but people want to act as if it exists. And that's even sometimes true of armed groups. And then finally, there's civicness seen as a political position, which is actually very important. In all our sites, we see mass demonstrations by people who are opposed to corruption and opposed to sectarianism. So this is something we're producing another special issue on. And so I don't want to go on at length, but I think part of the answer is how can you leverage civicness in order to provide an alternative to these two logics? But I guess Casper and Zainab and Shalini may have different answers to this question.
But maybe just to understand one point, what is your example of enumerated identities turned fuzzy again?
Oh, I would say the people who describe themselves as Yugoslavs in Bosnia. So, you know, in the Ottoman period, there were these, I've forgotten now what they're called. There were these religious communities that were created during the Ottoman period, whether they were Muslim, Catholic or Orthodox. The notion of Yugoslavia, the notion actually of Bosnia, was something that was really worked on and produced, the notions of brotherhood and unity. Mm-hmm. And people did accept them.
Mm-hmm. But they don't turn fuzzy again.
Oh, well, maybe I don't mean fuzzy, but they change.
All identities change. I think the interesting thing about Kaviraj's argument is that once you have a shift from these fuzzily contoured multiple identities two singular enumerated ones, because in order to enumerate, you must have a singular identity. Otherwise, I can't count numbers. I can't say sometimes I'm a Hindu, sometimes I'm a Muslim. But the 1920 census in India returned people.
I misunderstood what you meant by fuzzy. I understood it more as multiple identities.
No, not multiple. Fuzzy. The 1920 census in India says you are self-reporting. So the 1920 census has hundreds of thousands of people who report themselves as Mohammedan Hindus. This is an identity which today would be impossible. You are either Muslim or you are Hindu. This is a binary. You cannot be both. But these were people who are able to report those kinds of identities because those were their collective identities. These were before the process of enumeration turned them into one or the other.
I see. Well, so perhaps what I mean is multiple or inclusive identities, but it stopped. Maybe it's the difference between multiple and singular identities that I'm talking about, and exclusive identities, because we all have identities. Okay. And actually, in the Yugoslav census, I have one friend who's Jewish, and her husband filled in the census as Gentile. So people used all sorts of terms in Bosnia, lampshades, giraffes, whatever. So sorry, I misunderstood what fuzzy meant. But anyway, let me turn to Casper on this broader question.
Thanks a lot, Shalini. Well, first of all, I don't think we're claiming that we're saying something entirely new. After all, we are basing it on, let's say, one of the most cited social sciences of the post-war period, which is Bourdieu, but you know, you could have taken others. I do agree that there's a lot of very good literature along the same lines in terms of the construction of ethnicity and so on and so forth. So this is not very new. I mean, I could go into details about how this occurred specifically in the Congo, and there's also very good literature in the Congo about this, including David Newbery and Catherine Newbery and Mamdani himself. And so yes, so in terms of the contribution there, you'd have to go to, you know, some other articles where, you know, I describe in detail what happened in this region, and you know, and this is a different story. So that would be an empirical contribution also. But what we're trying to do in this article is to say, okay. There are different ways of approaching ethnicity, especially in the sort of say classical sort of tripartite division, which you know you can argue against it or not. And as you know, the library on reviews on ethnicity is you know immense. You know already you know so much has been written, so it's very hard to write something which is entirely new. So what we're trying to do here is when we look at the conflict in DRC. And we look at it only, you know, through the lens of constructivism, or only through the lens of instrumentalism, or only through the lens of, you know, primordialism, which of course you would never do. But in any case, something is missing. So what happens if we look at it in a sort of general economy of symbolic goods, which is what Bourdieu does, and which is so we turn ethnicity into a resource which can be converted into other resources depending on, you know, your social status, if you like. And so that's what we try to do. And this is the sort of theoretical move that they try to do. And this is why we call it ethnic capital. And, you know, we claim that it's a collective capital, but of course it's also always embodied by certain people. So that is, you know, but it's the limits of the article format. How much can you go into details? And, you know, it'd be fun, interesting to elaborate further on it. It's just, in my view, I haven't seen too much other than the work of Gilles de Ronsoro and his colleague Olivier Grosjean. I've not seen the concept of identity capital deployed, and so I thought, what if we think about it in these terms in the Congo with, you know, all the collective experience that we have, Tatiana Kuhn, Gudefan, myself, and what can we make of it in terms of, you know, how politics, the economy, and so on and so forth interact to make it sort of a broad analysis of this dynamics, sort of, and the interactions in, or interconnections. And so it's to kind of acknowledge the complexity of the interactivity, if you like, of economy, power, politics, and identity, And it's also to say, well, ethnicity is nothing special, you know? I mean, you can see it as a resource. It's one which is very evocative, of course, because it's based on certain very fundamental feelings about who you are, where you come from, who you belong to, which are, again, constructive, but nevertheless. So that would be my answer to that. In terms of the question asked, I don't know if I should jump straight to the question about, you know, what...
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, we had another question that I would like to link it with that about, you know, what should donors do about this? Let me say, first of all, I think that it's important not to overestimate ethnicity, but it's also not, you should not underestimate it either. Just because it's not, you know, primordial or objective or whatever, it doesn't make it any less emotional or effective, you know, as a tool of or a resource, if you like, right? Tool would be the wrong word according to what I just said. Because do not overestimate, because it's important not to label conflict as ethnic per se, since these conflicts are, you know, so much more than about ethnicity. It betrays a view of the conflict being about ethnic groups, both of which are misunderstandings, obviously. Even worse, that there's a real danger that this may contribute to a sort of reification of existing ideas about conflict being about ethnicity or between ethnic groups or caused by ethnicity, all of which is, you know, scientifically nonsense, if you ask me. And we should move away from this. So stop describing conflicts as ethnic per se, or thinking in those terms. You have, and which is why we think the idea of ethnic capital is useful to the extent that you need to see it as a kind of resource, which is part of a much larger political economic competition and so on and so forth. It's very important to understand then that the political work that is carried out through ethnicity or, you know, religious identities, you know, so don't underestimate it either. And then you have to analyze specifically what is going on and how it's being deployed, by whom, in the interest of whom exactly, and what is the relative value of you know, an identity category in the hands of X and Y person, who can mobilize it for what, for what objectives. This is very important to pay attention to if you want to act in this context as an aid organization or whatever, because otherwise you are a little lost. There's a chance you are a little lost in this, and this can be very dangerous. And then thirdly, I would be very skeptical about trying to engineer identity politics from the outside, you know, not to be very cheeky, but that's what the colonizers tried to do. You cannot, objectify, manage in terms of ethnicity. It's way too volatile and way too powerful as a sort of symbolic evocative. It doesn't work. It's not for outside organizations to manipulate or engineer this. I really don't think so. So, in terms of what can be done, the question asked by the. I would say that I am very, very skeptical. It's very, very difficult for me to say, because even at the, you know, all my experience in the Congo points towards the fact that it's very difficult actually to think outside of let's say the idiom of ethnicity, and I would connect that to patronage. And so the Congo and its sub, let's say, sub political orders are kind of like familial states, you know, that there is so much connected to the idea of kin and fatherhood and protection and reciprocity in familial terms, that citizenship it's integrated, it's actually integral to what we could define as citizenship in that context, the belonging to the community, the rights that you have. It's not on the outside it's a liberal democracy to the face of the world. There are elections, okay, they're compromised, but there are elections. It is a multicultural state, it's okay, but when you look at what really goes on underneath the surface, it's very, this is called patronage networks. And the point we were also trying to make is, do not misunderstand these as some kind of African culture, which is resurging again, or which is, no. You know, there are Christian values very strongly. You, should not forget in the case of the Congo that it was one of the places where Catholicism was most widespread. It was such a dense network of missionaries and so on and so forth. So this whole idea about the family father and so on and so forth, in my view, has at least as much to do with Christianity as with whatever pre-colonial culture that there was before, not to mention the idea of the state in itself. So citizenship let's say how to identify, I don't think you can say how to identify per se from the outside who's you know, a good player or a bad player or a constructive player. You have to meet these people basically and make your own judgments. And I cannot provide a general comment. Even the NGO sphere, I shouldn't even say even, because the NGO sphere in the Congo is also unfortunately very much along these logics. And you know, there's a saying in Congo, just to give you an idea, called combattant humanitaire, so humanitarian combatant. That should tell you something.
A fuzzy identity.
Very precise. It basically means that people shift identities according to the situation, and they have multiple identities, you know, according to the situation and so on and so forth. Okay, I think that goes for everyone in the world. When they interact in different contexts, they, you know, it's symbolic interactionism, Ella Goffman, right? And so I think, it's. I can't provide general advice. Basically, it would be way beyond my capacity. But it's to experience and meet the Congolese themselves, and it's for them basically, I believe, to redefine citizenship and what kind of society they want to build at all levels.
I think that was the reason we chose civicness rather than civil society, because NGOs are subjected to the same logics of money and identity, and civicness we wanted to show was something different. So I'll turn to Zainab now. I'm told we can keep going for another 10 minutes, if that's all right with all of you, because there are a couple, we'd like to get in at least two more questions from the audience. So Zainab, what would you, it's sort of response to Shalini and an answer to the question, if you want to answer the question.
Sure. I didn't talk about gender just in reference to women. Actually, I talk a lot about the paper in the paper about the specific forms of masculinity emerge in those contexts, but they still build on gender hierarchy. So gender being both relations between conceptions of gender. And in this context, obviously, patriarchal characteristics of gender roles are more prominent. And these are obviously giving power in that patriarchal structure to men rather than women, or to women who adopt those types of gender norms that maintain and sustain the power of men in socioeconomic life, in public life, in politics and in conflict. I think you had a question of plurality of the justice in terms of, so it's very difficult, you know, where can Yazidi women go? So in the international law, it's up to the national governments to carry out justice work. And the Iraqi state has not been willing to work with the international bodies to carry out this work. That's basically it. It hasn't incorporated the international norms and laws and the ICC courts of justice's work in itself. So there are, for instance, UN-led investigation groups carrying out work to gather evidence in Nineveh, in Mosul, but will they be actually taken into account as evidence by the Iraqi authorities? That's entirely uncertain. In allowing other forms of justice being carried out by groups, I wouldn't want to talk on behalf of Iraqis at all, but at least the Iraqis that I know would really dislike the idea. because they are all asking for a universally implemented, equal implementation of justice and laws that applies to everyone, irrespective of their gender, identity, religion, so on and so forth. So at the moment, there is already non-state public authorities very much interconnected with the state authorities. So there is a multiplicity of authority. And that's one of the problems that Iraq is experiencing, like the role of tribal leaders and religious leaders in Basra, and leaving them to make decisions about justice. I don't think many people, men and women, would want that. Some people might do, but I doubt most people would do. And justice based on whose definition, and do the people, not the religious authorities, who are coming together and execute, deciding on what they needs to be done. You know, who is being consulted? You know, the community. I think the community, the ordinary people, are the ones that are being again left at the hands of these authorities in a way to receive justice. I know the cases that you're referring to in Afghanistan, absolutely. And they might have been effective. So still, like, lots of people go to tribal leaders to sort out their problems because it's cheaper, it's easier. The Iraqi state has a massive progress. It's difficult to, you know, get things done unless you have a contact or you know, bribe someone. So sometimes having those connections really helps people. And people definitely utilize those contexts. And there is that existing institutionalized system in place, absolutely. But when it comes to criminal kinds of justice, you know, it can lead to arbitrary outcomes. So I'm not sure I would defend that. Rather than I think I would argue against it. In terms of Casper, I think put it really well. The answer, I would agree all with all his points on the question on who to work with. I think. And, you know, essentialization of identity is the problem. And this essentialization goes on in the minds of the international actors, but also local political actors. I mean, you know, the sectarian politics power holders have really benefited from this essentialization of identity and creating an us and against them and binaries and so on and so forth. The problem is not that these identities exist or not. I think they are used. There is a whole power dynamics going on in the background, and these symbols, identities, are just a way of are a way of structuring or facilitating the interactions, the power relations in those contexts. And I think international community essentializes these identities a bit too much. Like, I hear quite a lot about, you know, this, apparently there is this idea of there is an Iraqi woman, an abstract notion that represents all Iraqis. That's not possible. You know, the Iraqi women, the experiences they have beyond ethnicity and religion and so on and so forth, geographic location, urban, rural, habitation, their educational level, their ideology, their views, their opinions, you know, people have a choice when it comes to these things. And it's about focusing on this idea of choice rather than making a direct connection between particular identities and what they might want. Again, the same thing, Yazidis is a very small community, but people talk about Yazidi women as if there is this one woman that has experienced this context, where there are lots of very well-educated, very effective, included in social life, Yazidi women who have been carrying out important work. You know, it's a mixed community. There are mixed experiences, mixed positionalities, and we just need to understand that, accept that complexity and work with that. And the idea of creating justice from outside, creating peace from outside, overcoming these divisions from outside, you know, I think it's better to just work with the people in the way they want. And finding the right people is not easy, but stakeholders have interests. They are tied to specific power connections, and they have short-term, long-term interests. I'm not saying they are malicious or not. It's just there's a system in place. And there are those who are not at the table, who are not heard of. And they are the majority. And I think it's important to understand what they want and what they need. Like a typical example is the protesters in Iraq, for instance. You know, they are talking about things, and these are not external ideas. These are ideas that were already in the Iraqi history. You know, idea of gender equality, idea of peace, idea of justice. These are not alien ideas. Iraqis have been working with these ideas, have been fighting for these ideas, and many Iraqis have been doing that for decades. So bringing something from outside, I think just that mentality, I think is wrong. And I think we need to just dump that, to put very bluntly, and I will stop there.
Thank you, Zeynab. I'm going to turn to you, Sharlini, but before I turn to you, I'm just going to ask two last questions, which you can answer or not as you choose. And then we'll go back to Zeynab and Casper, and I'll say something at the end. We've got only about 5 minutes, so if you could each be 1 or 2 minutes. So the two questions are, what role can the diaspora communities play in unpacking identity challenges and contributing to the political religious identity discourse in their home country in the post-conflict stage? And if this role can be envisaged, what are feasible, what are the feasible roadmap channels for the diaspora to practice such agency? Take Syria as a case, with more than 8 million migrants living abroad, 5.6 million are refugees. And the other question, actually, maybe we'll just, the other question is, and you answer either, because we've only got 1 or 2 minutes each. To what extent does high-end violent technology act as the new status symbols to reshape and leverage identity on the fringes of the global economy? Which is actually not totally relevant to what we're talking about, but we do probably can make some points. I'll turn to Sharlini first, and she can make her response. And if she wants to answer the questions, she can.
No, I don't want to respond to those. I just wanted to say something to Kaya on this. I don't know if the two things very quickly. One, I don't know if the distinction between a justice which is coming from within and that which is coming from outside is a useful distinction, because international human rights laws are coming from outside and still you do want them to apply. So I don't think it's a good idea to make this distinction in terms of inside, outside, or who are the outsiders. I would go there. I would try to figure this out and configure this differently. But the other thing I just wanted to say is, I think there is interesting work you may want to have a look at. A lot of it is in French, unfortunately, because it's a French team, but they are writing in English. So I would look at Gilles Doronsoro's work on Afghanistan and on Syria, and especially Adam Batsko's PhD dissertation, which is an absolutely brilliant study of the kind of local justice which both in Afghanistan the local courts are providing, and the why the justice which is being propped up from the international community is failing. But the local courts are also not so local, because they are taking transnational Muslim legal kinds of ideas and bringing them to play in an Afghan village. So the local is not as localized as one would think. So I think one needs to also rethink what is local and what is transnational. It's not just the aid agencies which are transnational. A lot of the Muslim, the Islamic ideas of jurisprudence are also transnational. They're not always local. And his work on Syria, Gilles has done work on Syria as well, and so has Adam. And I would look at it to, I'm saying it's not about normatively saying ISIS is providing good or bad justice. It's about saying you are in also legally plural systems here. Just as I think George Elwood's idea of markets of violence was a very early idea of bringing the question of the competition. It is a market competition in markets of violence. You also have a competition as far as justice systems are concerned, and therefore norms are concerned. And you can have assemblages of norms which don't easily divide along inside and outside, or national, international, or what is the local.
Actually, we've been working with both of them. And in fact, I met Adam at your institute.
Yes, I think Adam's thesis is very, very good.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to let Zeynab and Casper have a minute each. Zeynab, do you want to add anything? Sorry, or answer to the questions?
In response to the questions, I mean, about the diaspora, I think the Yazidi diaspora in this case particularly has played a significant role. You know, talking about what Shalini was saying about transnational processes. So I'm someone who believes in the idea of getting rid of this local international division. And what is local anyway? We talk about local that exists out there, and then we don't talk about UK as a local context. So I think the way to go is transnationalism for sure. And I think feminist transnational literature is doing great work on that. And in my work, I mainly focus on, processes that actually show that this international domestic inside outside division doesn't really exist. It's so, the boundaries are so hybrid and fuzzy, and there's continuous interaction between them. And the diaspora case is a clear example of that. But when it comes to justice, I theoretically and normatively, I totally agree with you, Shalini. But in the Iraqi context, there is nothing wrong with the international law, ICC, International Court of Justice's jurisdiction in Iraq. And I think lots of people who have experienced injustice are asking for it, and they prefer this. And these are, I'm not disagreeing with that at all. I was mainly referring to the feasibility of it. Not that it's not possible, but it's not made possible by the Iraqi authorities. So that's one thing to be aware of. The diaspora has played a significant role, and they are still continuing to play, in terms of advocacy work. Lots of teams working with the UN are coming from Yazidi communities that have been living there in Germany, in the UK for a long time. So there's a lot of collaboration. They played a significant role in the transfer of Yazidi children and women to Germany. They took the lead on that. So they worked with the Yazidis in Iraq. So yes, and they collaborated with Iraqi authorities, Kurdish authorities, and the German authorities and other countries as well. So there is definitely a lot going on in the transnational realm that we don't really acknowledge always. I think Casper. That's my final comment.
Mm-hmm. Casper.
Well, I don't think that the diaspora should do something different than we should do in our own country, so to speak. Of course, there is a distance aspect, but it's to work for a kind of politics or let's say ethics, which is, things are not going to change because you behave, let's say, in a certain way or because you wish certain norms to come about. It, you have to engage in a kind of politics. I can't see, it's why I'm sort of skeptical of these sort of external aid interventions with huge budgets, which pretend to be apolitical. It's not that they don't bring effects or anything, or that, for instance, humanitarian aid should never be applied. It's not the point. It's just that, if you are a diaspora, maybe you are a refugee. You have to be part of the political game somehow. But how do you do that when it's dominated by logics which are deeply appalling? And how can you transform it? And that's an open empirical question in each case. And it's based on your resources available and the people that but mobilization. And it's I don't think there's a magic trick here. It's basically, I wouldn't say that, not that I'm a Marxist per se, but there's a struggle there. There's a struggle to be had, and you define, what kind of ethics you want to apply in that struggle, and that ethics is part of the struggle, if you ask me. But That's as far as I can go in that regard. And there's nothing wrong. I agree with there's nothing wrong necessarily with human rights or anything. And just because it comes from the outside, and yeah, completely in the Congo is also very much in demand. So is justice. But for some, of course, it's not. And some say it's Western ideology and whatnot. And so it's again, it's a struggle for the definition of legitimacy in terms of the order that's going to be built up, and how do you challenge the powers that be in the context and their modes of operating without, you know, aggravating the situation? Or I mean, you it's that there's no magic solution other than, you know, like I said, struggle. Alliance making. I mean, it sounds banal, but I don't see any other way, basically.
And let me just now finish, because we could go on for ages. I want to say on the diaspora, just very briefly, I think Casper's right. If we take the case of Northern Ireland, absolutely key was the shift in the Irish diaspora in America from thinking that they supported the IRA to thinking that peace was the way to get a united Ireland. That made a huge difference. And I use that example because it really depends on the politics of the diaspora. And there is a point discussing that politics. On technology, we don't have time, but the only thing I would say is that in the sort of conflicts we study, they mostly use what I call vernacular technologies, which means they use improvised explosive devices that involve local ingredients like fertilizers or detergents, but they make them very sophisticated by the use of mobile phones to trigger them, for example. And they use networks created by mobile phones, which are actually very sophisticated and which can, you know, the result of all this is that they're rather effective at blowing up tanks. So the difference between high-end and low-end technology has been dramatically reduced. On the justice, I think this is such a key issue. And I was very struck this morning reading that the protesters in Myanmar were all talking about the need for the ICC and the need for the ICJ. And this language is hugely important. And we now are seeing really important cases in Germany about crimes against humanity. And we just saw today that the ICC is going to investigate Palestine. So my feeling is this is a discourse that has had a huge influence and is beginning to become effective, and it's up to us to make it more effective. One of the conclusions from our studies is the huge importance of legal activism in conflict areas, whether it's local people collecting documentation to be used in courts, which we've followed quite closely in Syria, whether it's people... We set up court monitors in Somalia and South Sudan to follow cases, which is really helpful in making cases more transparent, making it more difficult for judges to be corrupt. There's so many things that can be done. And I think this is such a central issue in trying to address these contemporary conflicts. I'm not going to say any more because we've run out of time, but I really want to thank you. It was such a fascinating discussion. And thank you, Shalini, for all your comments. And thank you to Casper and Zainab. We need to continue this discussion. And thanks very much to the audience for holding out. I know quite a lot have left, but nevertheless, thanks for staying and listening. Thank you. Bye.